Good morning and welcome to the Monday Call. I'm Stefan Clark, Chief Client Officer, and I'm joined today by Mark Brooks, Portfolio Manager and Principal at the firm, and Casey Kuiper, Investment Analyst. The New Zealand and Australian stock exchanges, the NZX and ASX respectively, constitute only 2% of the global share market. Despite their size, these exchanges consistently provide attractive opportunities for investors with longer time horizons. Today, we will be discussing the benefits of portfolios having a meaningful allocation to local shares and dig into some of NZ Funds' largest NZX and ASX listed investments, such as Infratil, Synlait Milk, Meridian Energy, Ryman Healthcare, and Telstra. As part of this, we will cover why we believe these blue chip businesses, all held in NZ Funds' growth category portfolios, are set to drive strong returns for investors. Guys, thank you very much for joining. It's a really exciting topic we've got today, and I'm really looking forward to hearing from you and getting your insights on these companies and the broader setup of the market. Before we kick into the meat and potatoes of today's topic, I thought it'd be a good idea if we just sort of set the scene a little bit in terms of how managers think about investing and spreading their assets globally and locally. And my understanding, and you tell me if you see it otherwise, is that particularly over the last 20 years, there's been a big shift in the ability for investment managers to invest offshore. And there's very good reasons why to do that. For diversity, there's one of them, diversification. But at the same time, there's real benefits to having a meaningful allocation locally. So do you want to just touch on that, Mark, and tell us, yep. You know, what are the main drivers and how have things shifted over the last couple of decades?
Sure. So morning, Stefan. Morning, everyone. That's a great question. It's really why we kind of wanted to have a session on New Zealand and Australian shares. Yeah, NZ Funds does have a lot of our investments offshore. We talk a lot about those. You know, we've had our external managers, Fisher Investments and MFS, talk about a number of different sectors in their portfolios, and ultimately you get some pretty sexy, I suppose, for investment geeks like us, sectors like semiconductors and AI, etc., offshore. But for our clients in the growth category, a third of their exposure is in New Zealand and Australian equities, and we think there are some really key and important reasons why you want that to be the case. First of all, if you think about the nature of what we're trying to do. Yeah, ultimately, investment managers are trying to build long-term returns. And yes, you do want, everybody always likes a business that might double over time. But the reality is the way in which you build long-term returns is doing that sort of 7 to 10% per annum, year in, year out. And the New Zealand stock market has got companies, the large companies in New Zealand are perfectly suited for that. If we look at the makeup of that of the New Zealand market, it is very much dominated by those really kind of utility style businesses, big, mature, asset heavy businesses, many of which either have some form of sort of government ownership in the background, like the Gentailers, Meridian, etc., or historically may have come out of that space, like a Spark being the telecom of old. So, those sort of businesses where they are a cornerstone to life here in New Zealand, and they're not going away. The other aspect, I suppose two other really critical aspects of that, is that New Zealand companies tend to have very high dividend yields relative to offshore names. Yeah, and that's a factor, again, of the nature of the businesses. Being large and mature, they tend to have quite strong cash flows, and they pay that out to investors. So typically you're looking at dividends of 4% up, in some cases even sort of getting closer to that sort of double digit at a gross level. And the last one really is, and it's not to be dismissed, is really sort of the tax impact is, you have companies in New Zealand pay imputation credits. So if they pay tax, you get a credit for that. So ultimately, by investing in shares, and especially investing in shares through a PIE, the fact that the company has paid tax and you get credit for that really means it's effectively tax-free in your hands. So, across those three factors, that really seems like it's a great foundation for clients to look to build long-term returns by having a big chunk of money in New Zealand.
Okay, and let's just talk about the first one of there, just that 7 to 10%, and that being, you know, what she is to live over the long run. If you look back, you know, through markets, you know, the last 220 years or so that we've had markets, 7 to 10%. What does that mean? That means it doubles, give or take, every, if you've got a 7% return every 10 years, it doubles, right? So you, and we talk about long horizons. That means, in the first year, if you've got $100,000, say, you know, 10 years later, you're going to have $200,000. But then 20 years later, at 7%, you're going to have $400,000.
Exactly.
And then after 30 years, you're going to have $800,000. So the power of compounding is really profound. And if you can, you know, that's at 7% per year. If you're at 10% per year, it happens every 7 years. So it only takes 21 years, for example, to compound from, go from $100,000 to $800,000. So,
exactly. That's the point. And I think I've maybe touched on it in one of the previous podcasts, or at least certainly in client discussions. Yeah, there was I thought a really interesting headline recently about a property in Auckland that was brought for, like, sort of going off memory here, but $40,000 40 years ago, and recently sold for sort of $1.25 million. That seems like just an enormous difference, right? Actually, it ended up being about an 8% compound return. So really, that's that power of compounding. If you hold an asset that is going to appreciate in value, if you hold it long enough, and you will really get those, the power of that compounding drives that return. And that's really what we're trying to do with the New Zealand shares, is look at them. And as I said, clearly everybody likes to get a business that rapidly changes up in value. But ultimately what we want to do is have businesses that are predictable and have that return year in, year out. And the New Zealand share market, the large names in the New Zealand share market, really offers that.
It's a total cheese ball phrase, but I'm going to say it anyway. I really like the phrase in this context of, hitting ones and twos, not going for sixes, and that's how you win over the long run. And I think it's very much the same here, where particularly with, in this, local market, where you finding good yielding, strong, as we've called them, blue chip companies, and holding them for the long run, and that will, over time deliver.
Yeah, exactly. And if I look down the list of names that we have in sort of the top 10, Contact, Meridian, Chorus, Mercury, Telstra out of Australia, which is Australian Telco, Spark, the New Zealand version, Ryman, Healthcare, Somerset, the two retirement village names, and then Fletcher Building and CSL, another Australian business. Yeah, those are, I think the smallest of those has a market capitalization of $2 billion. Yeah. CSL, by far the biggest at $130 billion, but the New Zealand names, somewhere between $2 and $13 billion. So, they're not businesses that are going to go away.
Fantastic. Now, you talked about tax advantages and mentioned imputation credits, but there are other advantages, particularly if you're investing through a PIE. Do you want to just touch on those?
Well, ultimately, a PIE is capped from a tax perspective. So if you're on a higher marginal tax rate, now, especially for trusts, now moving to 39%, a PIE being capped on 28 is a massive benefit for that. And if you are on a lower rate, you get the benefit of that. You can claim back that aspect. So,
it's really, 28's the cap, right? So anyone who's above 28% will be getting a tax advantage through holding it through a PIE.
Correct.
Yeah. And a lot of people now, given tax creep and so forth, are sitting above 28%.
Well, that's been one of the, there's been a little bit of talk coming up to the election, but that's been one of the aspects that government's generally used over the last, well, frankly, probably the last 20 or 30 years, is keep those tax bracket, the nominal number, quite or very much unchanged. So you've definitely seen people move into those sort of higher tax brackets, definitely pretty quickly into that 33 bracket. Encompasses quite a large part of the population now.
Great. Okay. So we've touched on imputation credits and the benefits of PIEs to hold New Zealand and Australian equities. Now, what happens with capital gains? Take me through that briefly.
It is that issue that the fact that the income is fully taxed, so that's put to one side. And the nice thing about capital gains is, they are tax-free in your hand, ultimately. So it means you Yeah, what does that mean? It means you get to keep more of that compound, or more of that return for the compound long-term returns.
Okay, fantastic. Sounds, that's, you know, it's a good setup. Okay, so you've touched on the top 10 names. You sort of rattled them off. Casey, would you mind taking us through, there's a wide range of other securities, though, isn't there, on the NZX that we don't invest in? You know, how do you think about that?
Yeah, sure. Good morning. So part of our investment approach, the sort of the first tenet of it is that we need to make sure that this business is going to be here for 5 years, 10 years and beyond. And sort of part of our investment process is that we sort of look 10 years back into the history. What has this company done over the last 10 years? And what is our view on how they are going to proceed for the next 5 years? And in doing that assessment, we go through a bunch of different sort of tasks, looking at what is the market they operate in, what are their advantages, what are their threats, and then we dive deep into the business itself and, you know, how is this business delivering value and how do we think that this business will continue delivering value for that time period. And when we're doing this sort of research and analysis, that's when we can sort of uncover some of the issues that a company might face or some of the benefits that the company has as well. And through that process, we can filter out a lot of sort of companies that don't meet our investment criteria, and we don't think that clients' capital is well suited for that particular company. And going through that process, we debate those ideas and those reports with each other and the investment team. And through that, we can come up with securities that are well fit for client portfolios.
Yeah, really. Is it fair to say it sort of really provides that history going back, provides that context of, yeah, what does a business earn? What are its margins in good times and bad times? And, yeah, as always, what is the market willing to pay for that? Yeah. So it gives you that nice little box, right? It sort of says, well, yeah, or puts context in saying, well, at the moment, are we paying for peak revenue, peak margins? And we're paying peak multiples. And, yeah, I suppose actually I should go back a step. Yeah, what do I say when I think about multiples? For us, it's fair to say, Casey, you know, we look at things like dividend discount models, but very much it's a more a multiple approach. And, you know, what are some of the reasons why we like multiples over dividend discount?
I think a multiple approach allows us to compare very easily. So we can compare across markets. We can compare within the domestic market quite easily. And so it gives us a really good starting point of how do we think this business value compares to something else. And it also allows us to break a company down if we want to. So we can apply sort of a sum of the part valuation model to a particular company where we might think that a certain business division is worth a lot more if you were just to isolate that. And so by breaking your business down and applying certain multiples to different divisions of a business, we can sort of understand the true value of the business in our view a lot better and a lot clearer.
Yeah, it's a great point on that sort of segment analysis, but probably I should step back a little bit. We always kind of assume some people, everybody knows the jargon we use, but multiples is really just about sort of saying how many times earnings at its simplest are we paying for a business. So, yeah, if we brought a business in totality and wanted a 10% return, that's essentially saying we're paying 10 times earnings because over 10 years that'll pay us back. We get a 10% return off that.
And how does that differ from a discount? A dividend discount approach?
Dividend discount, we do look at dividend discount approaches, but really they are sort of looking at long-term, looking at cash flows out the long-term and really trying to sort of make a, there's a lot of assumptions that go into that in terms of really the things like the long-term growth rate. You need a long-term growth rate assumption. And you need to make assumptions about what you're discounting it back at over a long period of time. So one of the challenges there is, yeah, they tend to be very sensitive to those assumptions, both the growth assumption and the discount rate. And also, as Casey mentioned, it actually becomes quite hard to compare apples and oranges in that sense, whereas, yeah, if we're looking at a, yeah, a building products business on a multiple basis, really interested, you know, you can pull out, say, a concrete division out of that and say, well, yeah, we think this should be on this multiple because globally we're seeing concrete businesses trading on these multiples. So nice way to compare.
Okay. And so when we say just on that, the discount rate, that's really at its simplest, the interest rate plus some other factors you take into account. And when we talk about discounting cash flows, we're talking about trying to value today the present value of
future cash flows.
So, you know, a dividend's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, out into the into the distance. And so, and that is a very, very important and common model through which you can try to, you know, build a value for a business, but it has its limitations.
Yeah. But all models have limitations. It's just about working out which ones work well, and we like the multiple approach. The other one that Casey touched on, which I think often doesn't get the attention it needs, is really breaking up businesses into their constituent parts and looking at what we call the segments. And if we look at a annual report of a business, the first part we'll typically look at is the segment page. What are segment earnings? Is there, do they provide detail on what actual, what are segment revenue, and then do they provide detail of what the segment earnings are? And as Casey touched on, you can find some businesses where, one segment actually probably is worth more than the whole business, and the other segments are actually detracting value. So arguably that would say, the best aim for that business is to
spin out, or
even close the loss making ones. Yeah. And another example would be, and I won't name names, but historically we've had a few smaller retailers listed in New Zealand, general retailers, and actually the core retail business has actually been a host for a finance company ultimately that's been on the side that's made all the money, and the core retail business has actually been break even at best.
Righto. And then I guess the idea there is, just even bring it back a step further, you value these companies using multiples or other methods, and then you compare what the market price is today and what you think it is. And if there's a sufficient gap, or then you'll entertain purchasing it. Is that about right?
Yeah. So I guess one way you could look at it is that the market price, at every transaction, there's an agreement on price, but a disagreement on value. And so if we see a mispriced asset, in our view, we think we can get a sort of a higher return for the same level of risk or for a decent risk profile. And that's somewhere where we think we can put clients' capital and deliver sort of that 7 to 10% return.
Okay, great. Yeah,
so it doesn't necessarily mean the business is badly priced. It just essentially says, at this price, we're happy to be able to earn a 7 to 10% return. Then that works really well.
Yeah.
Again, the other point is by looking back through time, it gives you that ability to say, well, how much margin of safety do we think we have? Yeah. As I said before, are we paying peak multiples and peak, getting peak revenue, peak margins, peak multiples? Or actually is the market fairly depressed on a name and not actually paying much for it at the moment?
And with market cycles changing so quickly, and if you compare where we are today from where we were, say, 2 years ago, I imagine that having similar circumstances to look through 15, 10, 20 years ago, whatever it happens to be with respect to some of these businesses, will enable you to get a sense of how they perform in different environments.
Yeah, exactly. And that's been an interesting one this year, clearly. We've had very large divergence between what has happened in, say, the New Zealand market and to a degree even in the Australian market versus in the US. Yeah, clearly the US has been driven by that sort of higher growth, high tech, very technology heavy part, and especially a number of sort of 7 to 10 names within that at the pointy end of that, whereas we don't really have those. Well, clearly we don't have those names here in New Zealand or Australia to the same degree. So it tends to be, dare I say, it's probably a little bit more of a marathon rather than the. Whereas the US is a little more of that 100-meter sprint of the Olympics, whereas New Zealand's a bit more of the long game.
Okay, great. All right. Should we have a look at some of the companies?
Sure. Why don't we start off with Ryman Healthcare, something where we see value in. So for those not familiar, Ryman Healthcare, they're a sort of designer, developer and operator of retirement villages, and they have close to 40 villages across New Zealand and about 7 villages in Victoria, Australia. And so what these retirement villages really offer as a value proposition is that peace of mind, that convenience and sort of an engaging community lifestyle for residents that want to retire in peace and have a nice lifestyle. And these sort of villages, they offer sort of three types of products, like an independent unit, an assisted unit, and then a care unit. And the residents pay sort of fees for the upkeep of these units, things like utilities, general upkeep, and additional fees, depending on what the resident has selected as sort of optional extras. But it's important to note that these fees that are being charged by these operators aren't really the business model for the operator like Ryman. So Ryman will charge these fees, but if you look into their financials, they're more or less break even. So they don't really make money on providing these services to residents. Where Ryman's business model or profit model comes into play is the what many people know about is the deferred management fee. So when you buy a unit for, say, let's say $1 million and you want to enter the Ryman village, you pay essentially 20% of that $1 million over a period of 4 to 5 years. And so that accrues every year. And then when you vacate the unit at the end of your term, then Ryman captures that 20% of your $1 million upfront purchase price, and they capture any capital gains along the way.
So that's quite different, say, to a traditional commercial property model like precinct building we're in, where really a big chunk of their ongoing return is out of our rent, which more than cash flow positive on that basis.
Exactly. They could charge, let's say, $10 million in rent, spend $2 million on maintaining the building, and then they've got a steady stream of cash flow coming into the business. But that's very different for Ryman and other retirement village operators, where they only receive that cash flow every sort of 5 to 7 years or whenever a resident vacates the unit. And that can be quite challenging because on paper, the business model looks really good. This company is capturing capital gains multiple times and offering a great service. Residents love the service. But those cash flows are longer dated. And because there's such strong demand for these operators, they're continuously redeploying whatever they make into growing villages and building more villages. And so there are some concerns around sort of that deferred management fee. 20% is actually towards the lower end across the market. You've got other operators charging up to sort of 30%. And that sort of feeds into a little bit of the regulation risk around these retirement village operators. There have been surveys that show that a large proportion of residents don't disagree with sort of these arrangements and are not a big fan of not being able to capture capital gains along the way and things like that. And the retirement legislation is being reviewed at the moment. But what we are encouraged to see and what our view is that the role of or sort of the responsibility of government is to ensure that these services can be provided because they're not they don't have the capacity or the capital to provide these services outright themselves. So they're incentivized to make sure that these operators or they need to operate fairly, but also that they can provide the service on an ongoing basis. And so that's sort of where our position is in terms of the regulation risk around the retirement village operators.
In my mind, it's sort of back to that original comment you made, isn't it? That to a degree, it is a lifestyle choice. People are choosing to move into the villages for company and for ease of use rather than having the joys of maintaining a property, mowing lawns, all of that stuff, I would argue it's a separation of an investment decision with a lifestyle choice there.
Exactly. And the sort of demand for that lifestyle choice is growing by the day. If we sort of look at the demographics of New Zealand, we're sort of seeing, or Stats New Zealand is projecting, that over the next sort of 50 years, the percentage of the population that is in that sort of retirement bucket, so that over 65 bucket, will double over the next 50 years. And it's a similar story in Australia. So we've got this sort of structural tailwind for a long time of an aging demographic and the demand for these kind of services. So that sort of supports the structural story, the growth story behind these retirement village operators. And they've also got other factors supporting that. Like there's relatively positive stigma in New Zealand across the ditch for these retirement villages. It's not seen as, you know, putting your loved one in a home. It's more like you're sort of granting them this really lovely lifestyle where they can be in a group with peers and really enjoy that stage of life. So I think these are all things that are supporting the longer term retirement village growth story. And that sort of contradicted what we were sort of seeing, how the market was pricing these assets. When we were looking at how the market was pricing these assets, they were saying they were worth less than what the actual book value was. And so what the market is saying there is that, you know, these assets are overvalued. They won't be able to realize that. But they're also saying that there's no growth in the story. So we
that's quite a contrast to, I think, back in 2013 where Ryman was at 4x book value. Obviously, there was lots of growth coming. So the market was preempting future increases in book value, but 4x book value was pretty extreme.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And so a few months ago, the book value was about 0.8x. So it's about a 20% discount to what the accountants or what the valuers think these assets are worth. Now it's about closer to 1x. But at the same time, these assets, supported by a long-term growth demand growth story, aren't being ascribed much value to that growth. And so that's somewhere where we identified where we thought we could drive real value is in the retirement village operators in Ryman and Somerset. Not to say that it's without risk. There's obviously reasons why the market is pricing them at that value. And one issue that we saw earlier in the year was Ryman's capital raise. So they raised about $900 million because they got a bit too eager with their growth plans. Is that they had this interest-free source of funding from the resident deposits, but then they also added on bank debt, and then they also added on sort of private placement debt from overseas. And what happened was the housing market slowed down and it's deteriorated a bit, and then they were getting pressure on sort of their debt and their banking covenants, which meant that they had to do that capital raise. And that's an issue that sort of that debt issue, they don't have heaps of headroom on that sort of debt. So it's something that we're being mindful of and watching over the next 24 months.
That was something on the balance sheet was something I was going to ask about. But I think, again, having that starting point of saying, is this business stable? Is it going to be around come what may over the next 5 or 10 years? Really, that sort of is part of that discussion. Does the business have the capital structure in place, or actually the size that if it does start to get to a point where capital structure, the debt load becomes too large, that it can come back to the equity market and say, look, we'd like to raise some more capital and put a placement. If you're a smaller business, that becomes a much harder step. For a larger business, not necessarily great for existing holders, but there is definitely appetite to provide capital to those businesses when they want it. You know, how much did Ryman raise this year?
It was close to $900 million.
Yeah. Almost $1 billion in new capital. So that's, it's a massive number. And it was actually provides a great opportunity to, if you don't own the stock, to enter it in that situation, which we definitely upped our weighting at that point, right?
Exactly, yeah. That was sort of a catalyst for us to do a deep dive into the sector, and this is what we found. And so largely in line with Ryman, our sort of thesis for Somerset, which is also another holding within the sort of New Zealand and Australian portfolio, it's largely the same because these companies are both very high-quality operators of high-quality assets, and they have a more defensive exposure to sort of long-term property values, and they're supported by these strong demographic trends. that we think will endure for a long time. So we're quite happy in the sort of the longer term growth story for these operators. And over time, we think sort of the upside in our thesis will be realized as these, as the housing market settles and as these debt concerns alleviate a little bit, and sort of the regulation concerns ease a little bit as well. But over the long term, which is what we're sort of employed to do, is take these long-term views, we think it's a really solid option.
Yeah. The deferred management fee, I mean, when you think about it, as a business model, I would have, you could argue quite easily that it's in the interest of the residents, I would have thought, and that, you know, they don't have to realize an expense and have the cash flow available during the time that they're in the village. That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. As the name suggests, it's you're deferring your fee, so you can have a much more affordable lifestyle while you're at the village. And it also goes both ways. We know that over the long term in New Zealand, property has trended up. But also in situations where property doesn't go up, you don't have that downside either. So we have seen that sort of in overseas, in Australia, a sort of uptick in sort of capital gains sharing arrangements. But it's definitely not the most popular. I think what Mark touched on before is that this is really a lifestyle product. It shouldn't be seen as an investment or investment service, because that's not the purpose of it.
Fantastic. Okay. So we've covered Ryman and Somerset. Mark, you wanted to touch on Gentailers. Take us through that.
Bit of change of pace.
Yeah.
The Gentailers, basically the electricity companies. We call them Gentailers because they're a mix of generation and retail, whereas, you know, other parts of the world often generation and retail will be very separate. But this is, you know, ultimately, if there is one core sector in New Zealand or the New Zealand share market, that's really it, with you know, five major listed entities being Meridian, Contact, Mercury, Genesis, and Manawa Energy, the old what was Trustpower. In terms of our portfolio, we currently hold three names, being Meridian, Contact, and Mercury. And if we sort of just, I suppose, very briefly go through that, yeah, Meridian is sort of the standout operator, and most people recognise that. And why is that? Yeah, business is 93% hydro-based. Yeah, the true renewable energy producer with an asset base. You know, the beauty about hydro in many respects is, the life of those assets. Yeah, you build a large, you have an ability to build a large dam, which these days would be remarkably difficult. Yeah, imagine trying to go through a Resource Management Act process and negotiating with iwis and communities and trying to flood a valley. Very, very difficult. You know, I think there is some discussion down in Roxburgh at the moment about one down there, but yeah. Immensely difficult. So you have these assets that have very long lives, and actually the beauty of them is they don't take a lot of ongoing maintenance relative to their value. So that's really one of the key parts of the thesis for the investment thesis for the whole sector, is you've got an you've got a sector with a large inbuilt asset base, doesn't take a massive amount of ongoing capex. And, you know, what drives electricity prices? Yeah, ultimately, if we think about what's happening in the world, New Zealand has population growth at the moment. Yeah, we've seen good migration into the country. In fact, record migration. I think population's growing at sort of 1.5%, almost even up to sort of 2% per annum, given people coming in. That means more houses. That means more electricity use. And then, yeah, you flip that over to the whole, climate change discussion. What are we trying to do? Basically, we're trying to electrify the global economy. Again, that means we have more electricity use going forward. And, you know, and that's a segued into the wider investment case a bit quicker than I probably was intending. But if we look at sort of Meridian Contact, which is a mix of hydro and geothermal. and then at Mercury, which is very much North Island based hydro operator with some quite large wind assets. They're the largest wind generator in New Zealand. Yeah, ultimately, the mix of those assets are still there, and the demand for them has been driven by the demand for electricity. And we had a period about in the mid 2015 through 2020, where New Zealand's population wasn't growing as strongly. We were seeing some outflows. We weren't seeing the housing numbers being built like was probably really needed. And you did have a very flat period of electricity use. Now, very much, if we sort of look back through those long-term, back over those sort of last 10 or 15 years, there is a baseline electricity growth rate, and that is really good for these businesses. Again, they have large embedded assets. What happens with those in terms of inflation? Actually, they get harder and harder to replace, and they're worth more if you're trying to, just like trying to build a house. One of the drivers of housing prices is always construction costs. So, with this sector, very much a case where growing demand, asset base is worth more, and that we think that'll drive very stable and consistent long-term returns for the sector. They're definitely not going to be sexy. By definition, these are not businesses that are going to come out and necessarily go up sort of 30 or 40% a year, but they're names that are going to do, we'd expect should better do that 7 to 10 very reliably, very stable. And looking out the window here, it's raining. New Zealand seems to produce a lot of water, which is great for hydro businesses.
I think I might disagree with you, Mark, on that. The gentailers aren't that sexy, because if you sort of compare them to overseas generators and retailers, is that we're actually we're quite lucky and quite privileged to have these super high quality electricity generators that are largely renewable energy generation. And you don't get that everywhere. So in New Zealand, we're in quite a good position, especially from if we're looking at sort of an environmental impact, which we do for all of our investments. But that's quite a big tick, box ticked as well.
Well, two comments to that. Good. One, good to see I'm not the only investment geek here. And two, that's a really good point. You look at somewhere like Australia where still a big chunk of their energy use is coal-based, et cetera. New Zealand's in a great position from that point of view.
So, I mean, there's really three major tailwinds, right? And you've got, as you mentioned, you've got population growth, there's electrification, there's more and more EVs get used, and more generally we move off fossil fuels. That will be supporting the sector. And then there's just economic growth generally, which drives demand for electricity.
Exactly.
So, like Ryman, strong tailwinds. And in this case, a sector that's dominated by local players. I mean, I was thinking about how it's quite different from, banking sector, which is another major portion of the New Zealand economy, but it's significantly owned by Australian operators. This isn't the case here, right? So mostly New Zealand shareholders and the government.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, that is the positive case. There's always... I suppose risks on the horizon. Yeah, big one obviously for Meridian is Tiwai Point. If that was to end, that would essentially dump a whole lot of electricity effectively into the New Zealand market, which personally I think would probably be a good thing for the New Zealand consumer. Would not necessarily be a great thing for Meridian in the short term, but or actually any of the electricity companies in the short term, because it would lower prices. But in the medium term, they're still producing electricity with a relatively almost zero marginal cost in the case of the hydro businesses. So they'll better sell that, and they'll work through those bumps if they come.
Very good. Okay, so we've also got another business which in many ways has parallels to an energy company, Chorus. Take us through that.
Chorus, I think one thing was very interesting out of the the devastating floods that sort of the East Coast had was that for the first time, you know, Chorus was really talked about as an essential utility, having internet as your as one of your utilities, yeah, along with water, along with electricity. And, yeah, that is, I think, something which people have typically underestimated with the Chorus business, is that it is a utility and you should treat it that way. In terms of the business, yeah, was the, I suppose, was part, you know, just as a little bit of history, was part of Telecom and was split off. And when you had Spark, the retail side, and then really the infrastructure side being Chorus, originally owned the copper lines for the old, what they call the POTS telephone lines. And, yeah, was the, essentially was the backbone or the primary rollout business for fibre broadband that I think, you know, what was it? It was probably 10, 12 years ago now. And today, yeah, Chorus has 83% of the fibre network, a number of smaller, what they call local fibre companies, certainly in the Christchurch region and other places, sort of Hamilton area and up north, are not Chorus built out, but Chorus has built out the backbone of the fibre network. And that is now broadly complete. And, you know, as you sort of touched on in terms of the that asset base, that is treated, you know, very much like a utility. And it's actually run, it's a highly regulated business. Ultimately, Chorus is what sort of a B2B business. So they don't sell to you and me. They sell to the retailer, to the Spark, to One, or Vodafone, those sorts of groups. And what they can sell at is highly regulated around what they call their regulated asset base, their RAB, and that's set in conjunction with the Commerce Commission. One of the nice things about the regulated asset base and inflation is that that regulated asset base does increase when it comes up for review period every sort of 4 years or 5 years. That increases, and you know that's got an asset base which is going to increase over time. So we do like that. In terms of the business and a little bit of its history, one of the interesting or more challenging aspects of looking at this business over the last 5 years has really been the build-out. And in terms of, if we look at, you know, a really close comparison would be something like a Vector. So the lines, electricity lines company here in Auckland listed, tends to trade on about sort of 11 to 12 times EBITDA. In terms of, yeah, business is essentially the same. They're delivering electricity. Chorus is delivering internet. With the build-out, essentially Chorus was earning EBITDA, but they had very little or negative cash flow, but quite negative cash flow due to the build-out and all the CapEx spend. As that build-out's finished, that business has become more, has turned positive in its cash flow and will continue to move more positive over time. And really would expect that to sort of, yeah, continue to trend. And it's quite similar now in terms of its valuation, trend towards a valuation as a Vector or even some, you know, sort of a premium asset, a bit like Meridian, which you can't replace. I think the other aspect there, which is really interesting about this business, is, and as I touched on, you know, the floods on the East Coast have, I think there's been probably an acknowledgement about doing more work around resiliency and future-proofing our networks more generally, be it water, be it electricity, be it internet. And, you know, that is, you know, perversely, that's kind of a growth capability for that business, is how do they sort of build in that resiliency? And because it's a regulated business, they will get credit for that capital expenditure, much like a lines business would get credit for, you know, future-proofing or building resiliency in their electricity lines. So, you know, it's a business which probably here and now is relatively fully valued, I think. But yeah, we like it as a core stable part of the portfolio.
Okay,
that was a long monologue.
It was, but no, it was great. And obviously, as a Alliance company, Lines companies face the challenge of solar and some other sort of unique things going on. Wireless is a challenge, presumably, for Chorus. How do you sort of think about the market developing?
Yeah, it is a challenge without a doubt, but I think they do have the luxury really of kind of having that inbuilt and sort of first mover advantage. Yeah, I have fiber at home. Am I ever likely to change to wireless? I find it really difficult to see. So I think it's more, marginal's the wrong word, but I think it will be it's a very viable solution, but one that will be around the sides or the margins, either for areas that are more difficult to access with fiber or, sort of flatting examples where people are moving around more. But if you haven't, so many properties now have fiber embedded, really just easy to switch it on and it works.
I think it's important to sort of distinguish with wireless broadband. While it is really good in some cases, like regional examples and things like that, and we can dig into it a bit further if we talk about sort of Infratil or Spark, is that the main motivation behind this wireless broadband being pushed is not as much so because it's a much superior product. It's more so because the telco operators earn a much higher margin from it because they're providing it off their own network as opposed to having to go through Chorus and effectively just reselling their product. So that's a big driver of why you might see wireless broadband being pushed more into the market as opposed to it being this, fantastic product that's much better than fiber.
Yeah, it's a great point.
My understanding, not a technology wizard, but fiber is meaningfully faster than wireless. So for corporate type businesses, it will never really be an option to move off the network.
You've got advantages in not only speed but also latency and reliability of the network. It's a superior product in all ways, in my opinion, if you can actually get access to it. It's a different story if you're out in rural New Zealand and you can't get that fiber cable to your door, then you have to pursue another solution. But for where the fiber infrastructure is, it's hard to see something that will overtake that in terms of sort of those three factors being speed, reliability, and latency.
Yeah, it is fair to say that given fiber is based on glass cables, there is a lot of ability in terms of essentially the boxes they attach at either end to increase their speed over time. The expectation there is no real limitation yet on fiber speed. In terms of wireless, essentially the technology to date we are just working through iterations of 2G, 3G, 4G, 5G. That's still the same technology. Speeds are getting quicker, but the ability, or I suppose the breadth of coverage at each level is getting narrower. So it becomes harder to continue to upgrade those speeds over time.
Very good. Now, Fletcher Building, another important name. Take us through that one.
quite different to what we've been talking about, in the sense that ultimately, the businesses we've been talking about so far are stable. Core parts of New Zealand's infrastructure with large asset bases. Fletcher Building, definitely a core part of the New Zealand landscape, but not an infrastructure business. Ultimately about really building products and building stuff. And what is that industry? It's highly cyclical. Right. So, we need cyclical businesses, or they provide a nice opportunity within the portfolio. And, if we look at something like Fletcher Building, broken up across its building products division, which is essentially, GIB at its simplest. I'm probably being way too simple there. it's got its concrete division. It's got its distribution division, being Placemakers, which essentially sells GIB. Again, probably way too simple. And then it's got its construction divisions, being housing construction and large project construction.
Yeah, there's more to the industry than just GIB.
Yes. Yeah, there'll be lots of tradies out there.
Outrage, I'm sure.
Exactly. But that sort of comes back to sort of Casey's point earlier. This is a business you really have to look at each segment and understand how each segment is is going, where the where it has been over time, and where, you know, what is the revenue, what are the margins. And often in these cases, yeah, you can have one sector, yeah, being like, you know, for example, some of the large project infrastructure sectors can be a very real drain on the core part of the business, and that has been the case recently. But, yeah, again, without going to sort of, yeah, the numbers per se, I think, yeah, Fletcher Building is this great example that if you look back through time, you can see, well, what has the market been willing to pay for this business in the low times? And, yeah, yeah, essentially when you're paying, yeah, you're probably paying somewhere around about sort of 5x EBITDA at the moment, yeah. It's never, because it's cyclical, it's not a business you're ever going to pay 12 or 13 times EBITDA. Yeah, peaks, yeah, probably, I haven't got it in front of me, but yeah, you probably peak EBITDA would be almost like 9 to 10 times. But if you can buy it at half that, that is a great opportunity. Real challenge with these businesses is you need to buy them when nobody likes them. And, you know, given it, what was it, 2 weeks ago, had a essentially a cut to its dividend, and definitely had some fairly muted forecasts. You're seeing that business trading near the lowest prices it's been for a long time. So it's really, yeah, it's a name which we think is a key part of the business, a key part of the economy as the property market starts to settle and turn around. Some good opportunities there.
I think with Fletcher's is you- it's such a core part of sort of New Zealand, is that if you're taking over the next 10 to 20 years, if you're taking a positive view on New Zealand, you can sort of take a positive view on Fletcher's as well. The two will sort of mingle together. Yes, there will be ups and downs on the journey, but in the long run, it should be a positive one.
And you know, there are definitely arguments for and against this in terms of, yeah, competitive pressures, but, and there's been a lot of questions over the competition or the the validity of competition in the building sector. But, you know, I joke about JIB, but it is such a core part of, you know, construction in New Zealand. And, you know, competition, there has been competition from, you know, Boral came in a number of years ago with their US counterpart, who were the inventor of JIB, and as they call it, sort of JIB rock, and, you know, struggled to compete because they didn't have production facilities in New Zealand and, you know, didn't have that sort of regulatory sign-off where, you know, everybody in councils around the nation knows that JIB is, you know, it's there, they can tick it. So there's a lot of sort of inbuilt moats from that business that actually make it really attractive as a long-term hold.
Chinese imports were coming in at the end of the COVID period. There was obviously a moment in time when JIB was extremely hard to source, and an uptick in imports kicked off at that stage. But it's has that continued, or is
I think at the margin it does continue, but again, it's you know, we sort of touched on a little bit the distribution business and things like placemakers. But yeah, if you are building, yeah, 1,000 houses a year, you can probably do that, and you have the balance sheet to, yeah, put aside, yeah, 30 containers full of JIB. But if you're a smaller builder, or you just want to manage your inventory levels and not have to store things, be able to call up, yeah, placemakers and order it and have it delivered in 3 days. Now that the delivery times have improved again, is a major positive for most. So it's a major selling point for their business.
Yeah. Okay. And obviously, builders or Fletcher Building being involved in so many infrastructure projects, and a lot of infrastructure needing to be built, would be a tailwind that within New Zealand.
Mostly. Yeah. It's fair to say. Yeah, one of the real challenges for any large-scale infrastructure provider is at different points in the cycle, there will be a they will bid for something which probably is not economic ultimately.
Right.
We're probably coming to the end of that cycle, especially Fletcher's have some issues with the Sky City Convention Centre. It would suggest, that's the value of looking back is, when were people competitively bidding and when are they the only bidder or one of the few bidders?
Yeah, and I think my understanding is that they often price in a way that ensures they get the cash flow, but they know that they're not going to make a margin until there's, change of scope or something like that. So the tender process is fraught too.
Correct, yeah.
All right. Conscious of time and lots of great companies that we're holding in the portfolio. Take us through Synlait as our last, which is a different proposition from the others, and yet as an investment, you we're really interested in.
We figured we'd need to put something in there. It was a little
blue chip, so to speak.
Yeah, I wouldn't say Synlait is a blue chip per se. I think that's a tough argument, but I think on the contrary, it's got a pathway to becoming a blue chip, right? It's sort of this turnaround story. And for those that don't know, Synlait is a producer of sort of these high quality dairy products. So they do things all across the value chain, like sourcing the milk, the raw materials, working with their partners to ensure quality and manufacturing, helping them get regulatory approvals and distributing their products. So while you might not see the Synlait brand name in any supermarkets or anything like that, they do a lot of work behind the scenes. And so they've got this big network of farmers where they can source this milk from, and they keep it sort of separated throughout the supply chain, allowing themselves to sort of create these differentiated products, which they can then charge a premium for. And so they've got these massive factories in Canterbury and Pocono. And through these factories, they're creating these products, and they sort of have three different categories of product. And the one that people will probably most be familiar with is the sort of the A2 product, or the A1 protein-free milk. And so A2 Milk is the company there, is the biggest customer in that segment, and that's sort of what the company's really been known for. But quite topical is that in recent news, the farm gate milk price, or the global dairy prices, have fallen quite significantly, and so some people might think that would have a huge impact on Synlait. But as a sort of a manufacturer and a dairy processor, they're actually quite insulated from that farm gate milk price, and it's more about what kind of margin they can achieve on the manufacturing side of things. And the margin that they could achieve on the manufacturing largely depends on what kind of product mix they have. So the main products they make is infant milk formula, and so they also make fresh milk and cream and things like whole milk powders. And you will have also seen their sort of consumer foods. So in the supermarket, you would see something under a brand called Dairyworks or Talbot Forest Cheese. So they make a wide range of products, but by far the highest margin product is the sort of those nutritional products, like the base infant milk formula. And so what we've seen over the last few years is that Synlait has struggled because the amount of infant milk formula has gone down relative to the other products they're making. So although their revenue is increasing over the last couple of years and their production is increasing, their bottom line isn't reflecting sort of that progress. And so Synlait's biggest end market is China at the moment, and the regulatory regime around exporting infant milk formula into China is extremely strict, and it's very difficult to do. It's done on a factory-by-factory basis. There's a lot of sort of regulation points in between. And so Synlait has received a new sort of registration for its big factory in Dunsandel in Canterbury, which allows them to export and produce within that factory all the way throughout to 2027. So that in itself is quite valuable, in my opinion, is just being able to export into that market. But China's not the only market by far. There's a lot of demand for sort of high-quality infant milk formula and the sort of A1 protein-free milk formula across the globe. If we compare them just quickly to Fonterra, back in 2019, Fonterra's market share was around 81%. of milk produced, and Synlait was about 4%. So Synlait's still very small, but if we look back to 2001, Fonterra was at 96%, and the rest of the market was a piddly few percent. So that trend of smaller producers taking more share over time is quite positive. The reason why we sort of see value in Synlait is that effectively right now, again, it's sort of a sort of price to assets argument, is that we can buy these super high quality manufacturing assets. It's a great piece of infrastructure to process dairy products. You've got high quality manufacturing, a valuable export license, and it's demonstrated the ability to generate sort of double digit return on assets in the past. And it's a critical part of A2 Milk's supply chain. We don't think that the sort of 50% discount to its book value is necessarily warranted. And again, there's no free lunch in markets, unfortunately. And there are reasons for why it's trading in sort of those depressed levels. And one of those is that Synlait's downgraded its earnings 3 times in quick succession. It's the weak sentiment in the Chinese infant milk formula market. And there's also this sort of debt issue within the business. So it's not without its challenges. But we think that if Synlait can push through, where there are ways that it can push through, over the long run, it's got that pathway of becoming a blue chip business. It's a great piece of infrastructure, and it's somewhere where we see real value. I think an interesting point what was in the news recently about Synlait is that they wanted to sort of divest that Dairy Works and that Talbot Forest cheese brand, which they bought back in 2019 when they were like high flying. So if they can get close to the purchase price of what they paid for it back in 2019, that would go a long way in sort of resolving some of those debt concerns. But all in all, we think this is a high quality franchise over the long run, and it's somewhere we think is a bit mispriced, where we see really attractive value over the long term.
To put that another way, though, you've also got this massive margin of safety if you're getting assets at 50 cents on the dollar. If the thesis doesn't work out, and in an extreme situation, the business needs to be sold to other players, there's going to be demand, you would expect, for those high-quality assets.
Exactly. And it is what we touched on before with the sort of the export license to China. It is quite a valuable asset base for someone looking to enter the market, or someone, looking to expand their operations, which could be something like A2 Milk taking over more of the supply chain, or even Bright Dairy Foods, which is a major shareholder of Synlait stock.
It's not easy to build a milk processing plant. You just need to drive past them, and they're amazing structures. And so I can understand, not on that basis, on the valuation basis, of course, why it is it's compelling as an investment proposition at this point in the cycle.
Well, again, as a bit of a tangent, think about sort of the concept of sort of either buying a house that's been renovated or going through the process of doing the renovation. A lot of people will say, well, actually, if I can buy something that's built and in place, I'll take that.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, Mark, Casey, thank you very much for your time and taking us through the companies and the New Zealand market as an investment opportunity for investors locally and why it is so compelling. Have a great week.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This has been The Monday Call, brought to you by NZ Funds. New Zealand Funds Management Limited is the issuer of the NZ Funds KiwiSaver Scheme, the NZ Funds Managed Superannuation Service, the NZ Funds Advised Portfolio Service, the NZ Funds Wealth Builder, and NZ Funds Income Generator. A product disclosure statement for each is available at nzfunds.co.nz. Past performance is not necessarily an indicator of future returns.